Okay. Let's see. We were up to a little bit of material on what happens when there's variation of rates of evolution between different sites, because then we'll get into protein, models for proteins. And the fact of variation of rates from site to site in DNA is a very important fact, particularly when there are regions that are being conserved because of function. And those are not only exons, but various regulatory region sites that have to be conserved in introns, etc. There is, by the way, a myth out there that is frequently cited when people are trying to argue that there is no such thing as junk DNA. They usually start by saying, biologists used to think that all the DNA outside the exons was, you know, was junk. But now we know there isn't any junk, and so on. The myth is a complete myth, because people always knew there were regulatory regions that didn't know how they worked, but they always knew they were there. When people say that, you can be pretty sure that they don't know what they're talking about. Hang on a second, I didn't plug something in. To run out of power. Okay, so when you're doing calculations for DNA-based distances, you're making the assumption, all the formulas make the assumption, that every site is changing at the same rate. So what can you do about that? Well, one thing you can think of doing, first of all, is to use the fact that in all of these models, the time, the length of the branch in time, comes in multiplied by a rate. So if you have the transition probability under any of these models, under, for example, Jukes-Cantor or Kimura 2 parameter, any of them, the probability, the transition probability, the probability that if you start at state I, you end at state J, in a branch of length T with a rate R, is in fact a function just of one thing, the product of those R and T. They come into the formula. That's the way I've written it here, isn't mathematically quite okay, but they come into the formula as their product. Okay. So what that means in turn is, if you want to calculate what happens with twice as high a rate of evolution, you just have to use the formula for twice as long a period of time, because that will get you to the proper product. So higher rates are like longer times. They have the same function. If you have some distribution over sites of rates of evolution, then you can get the transition probabilities at each site by computing the probability. I mean, when you do distances by likelihood, as a likelihood for a two-species tree, you're in effect computing the probability that you get both of those sequences, which is the probability at this particular site of starting in state n sub I for site I, and then times the transition probability, which is a function of this RT thing. And what you will have to do, if you have a distribution of rates, and if you're going to assume that the rates are randomly assigned to the sites, is average that over a distribution of rates, and the mathematics looks like this. There's a density function of rates distributed from zero up to infinity. They can't go negative. And you average them over all possible rates by integrating against that. So, but you don't actually do this in practice. I'm going to show you how the formulas get simpler. And you want to do this for every site, and if you're going to assume that the sites are assigned independently from site, the rates are assigned independently from site to site, you're going to take a product over sites. The index here is I. So you can imagine yourself computing this thing and maximizing it, finding that the branch length, in this case T, that maximizes that. Okay, well, that's in theory. That's abstract. In practice, what you do is you take a particular distribution. And there's a whole bunch you can use. I mean, you could use log normals and inverse Gaussians, and I think there's something called an inverse gamma. But the one that is most widely used is the gamma distribution. And the gamma distribution is a distribution of things on a scale 0 to infinity. And it has two parameters, so you can manipulate by messing with those parameters. You can manipulate, you can set the average to whatever you want, and you can set the variance to whatever you want. Now, before we even get into showing you pictures of this distribution, I want to say that you may ask, what is the biological reason why this is the right distribution? And the answer is, the biological reason is that it works out well mathematically. And as we know, reality conforms to our models, or else. I mean, we impose our models on reality in this case, and in many cases. Now, the gamma distribution looks like a constant times, let's see, this is a distribution, this is a bit misstated. It says f of r. These x's should be r's. They're the thing, they're the variable, so it's the rate. It's times the rate to the alpha minus 1 times e to the minus something times the rate. And those are parameters, alpha and beta, and when you write them down, when you figure out what the average rate is in this distribution, it's the product alpha beta, and the variance is alpha beta squared. If you want to make the average rate be 1, which is the standard way of standardizing things, you have to set beta equal to 1 over alpha, and then you plug in there, and you get this distribution, which is now correctly stated with this variable being r instead of x. But again, it's constant times r to the something times e to the minus something, only now only alpha comes in. And the thing that is of interest in this, we've got the mean of the distribution set to 1, that's nailed down one parameter, and the variation, variance is going to be a function of alpha, so in fact the variance will be 1 over alpha, and that works out. So if you know what a squared coefficient of variation is, it's a sort of squared fraction of variance. It's the fraction that the standard deviation is of the mean, and that squared, well, that's 1 over alpha. So a large value of alpha gives you a very narrow distribution around that mean, and a small value of alpha gives you a spread out distribution. But what do they look like? Well, they look like this. I've plotted here for three different values of alpha: alpha a quarter, alpha 1, and alpha 2. I've plotted what the gamma distribution looks like. For alpha equal 4, remember I said that for large values, the distribution gets narrow. If you took an alpha equal to, say, 1,000, what it will turn out to be, it'll have an average of 1 and very little variation, so it'll be this sort of spike sitting on 1. The spike will look like a normal distribution. It isn't quite a normal distribution, but as you get to these large values, it gets closer and closer. For alpha equal 4, it's spread out. It has an average of 1. Now, you may look and say, wait a second, that average is not right under the peak. And the answer is the distribution is skewed. It doesn't have to be under the peak. It can be. It is the mean. It's out here. Because of this big long tail, it gets a little to the right of the peak. And you'll see it's spread out, but you could look at it and say, well, it's not a normal distribution, but it's generically a single peak distribution. When alpha equal 1, it's this shape, and what that is an exponential distribution. It's just an e to the minus x curve. So it's not peaked anymore. It has a mean of 1, but it spreads out some. When alpha equal a quarter, it's this very J-shaped distribution. It's a big long tail. There's actually a fair amount of area. When you consider that the mean is here, it means there's a fair amount of area out there, not a half exactly, but a reasonable amount. And then there's a fair amount of area right down near zero. So that's a case where lots of sites have rates of zero. A fraction of them, reasonable fraction of them, has higher rates. And we've adjusted things so that the average rate is 1. So the thing to say really is, by tinkering with this parameter alpha, you can deal with cases where there isn't much rate variation, where there's a moderate spread of rate variation, and where there's a rather extreme spread of rate variation. So it's convenient distribution for that. It's also convenient because when you integrate it against things that have e to the minus something, things work out nicely. Make another adjustment here. If I plug in the power cord, it's good to connect it to the computer. Okay. So what happens? Well, again, I'm not really going to hold anybody for this algebra, but you can take for the Jukes-Cantor distance where the sufficient statistic is the fraction of sites that differ, and you can calculate that. Let's call that d sub s. I think we called it something else earlier. You can put the gamma distribution in here, the one that's adjusted so it has a mean of 1, and then you can do the integral. And when you do, what you come out with is a function, which I'm not showing you, and when you solve it for the distance, the solve it for basically the time. Let's see, what am I looking at here? By the way, formula's a little wrong because it shouldn't have this u in here. It should just be t. We solve basically for t times, basically for t, you get this. And if you look at it, it doesn't look like the formula for no rate variation. For no rate variation, we got a formula involving the log of 1 minus 4/3, the difference. There's no log here. But what happens is, it's got alpha in there. If you take alpha towards, if you take alpha towards out to infinity, basically, if you make this shape coefficient alpha, which is the reciprocal of the coefficient of variation, if you take that off to infinity, that means the distribution of rates gets very narrow. You can show that this thing approaches that formula. It approaches the logarithm. So it's a funny thing involving powers, but it works out nicely. And basically what it's going to get you, let's see, I don't think I have a plot of this, yeah, is the former curve, the fraction of difference as a function of the branch length. You may recall that it went up sort of linearly and then healed over and approaches a limit of 3/4. In this one, it goes up at a certain rate, and then it heals over more quickly. And all that depends on alpha. Because basically what's happening is the sites that are going fastest are changing right away, and the sites that are going slower take a longer time before they start to change, and it just gives you a different shape. Okay. But in principle, this corrects for the variation of rates. Yeah.
So d basically equals the branch length.
The t here is because the r is not a single number, it's a thing you're integrating over, so you can't have it in the formula. Okay. You integrated it out. And the u doesn't exist at all, it shouldn't be in that formula. Okay, well, so much for the algebra. You can do the same thing. I just want to say that for all the other models, they all have transition probabilities that are something plus something times e to the minus something plus something else times e to the minus something else. all of those work nicely when integrated against, when integrated against the distribution of rates. Here is showing the expectation over R. It's this integral thing, and that works out to a formula that you can write down. So you can basically use it for any other for anything in the Tamura-Ney family, and I think you can even do it for generalized reversible models. But anyway, just to say that gamma distributions have a couple parameters, one to adjust the mean, one to adjust the variation. They work out. Okay. So I'm going to come back to this in a lecture or two from now when I talk about, maybe on Friday, when I talk when I'm talking about likelihood machinery to obtain maximum likelihood trees. We're going to revisit this whole business and look at the issue of how you do the computations for a likelihood tree where you have to use a somewhat different hidden Markov model machinery. And I'll come back and tell you about that. But it'll be using the same kind of assumption that there is a distribution of rates and that you're averaging over it, but doing it a little more specifically. So I'm going to shift gears now into, and I keep using that analogy, and then all my life I've been saying, and I'll shift gears, you know, and it hits me that I've got a generation here that never drove a stick shift car. And I better totally stop using that. Sorry?
It's not totally true yet.
Not totally true yet, but it's getting there. Anyway, I'm going to shift gears, as we geezers say, I'm going to go into the subject of protein models for protein sequences. But before we get there, and any questions about the DNA stuff up till now, if anybody has any, this is a good moment to ask it, because we're going to move to slightly different material. Yes?
How do we specify the
hotspots? That is a good question. For likelihood methods, you can do it by actually just trying different values and using the one that maximizes the likelihood. For distance methods, it's a little fuzzier. And probably there are crude approximate ways, and I'm basically not... don't remember them very well, so I'm going to not say. But if you think you know it, if you can get some empirical measure of how much rate variation there is from site to site, you could use that alpha if you can get it. But that's not answering your question. That's saying that there might be an answer, only I don't know it offhand, A. And B, if you know it in advance, then you can put it in the formulas and make it work. Yeah?
Have you heard about gene duplications influencing the rate of mutation?
Which duplications?
Gene duplications.
Gene duplication.
Yeah.
Well, certainly after a gene duplication, where you have two if you have two copies and they're both functional, there is a new situation. Yes, it will cause rate changes. Often, one of them may, for example, remain functional and the other might deteriorate and then become effectively junk DNA, and that will go at a different rate. Mostly we're not faced by that immediately. It's an example of a real complication. You might really see it in a tree with many species. You might say, oh, here, now there are two loci.
An organism has a higher rate of gene duplication than another organism.
I think that's getting finer grained than we can come near at this point. If you were to see in a tree with gene duplications in it, you would see that the gene you're looking at is in one copy in a whole bunch of them, and then in two copies in others. And there is then the very real issue of how do you fit this tree of copies to the tree of species. There's all kinds of methods for that. Then if you were saying, well, I also want to do a maximum likelihood estimation of branch lengths and topologies and things, you not only have to do that, but then in principle you should take into account that after the duplication one might change at a different rate. In practice, I'm not sure I know of anybody who's ever really tried to do that whole machinery, that whole problem, and solve it. It's real. Fortunately, many loci you look at have only one copy. All of the data examples I gave you in the course are just a single copy gene. I think when you look through that database, they generally don't have many duplicated genes in there. Not because they don't exist, but they've done like 14,000 genes out of, you know, it's maybe two-thirds of the loci in those organisms. The others might be the ones that have some gene duplication issues.
What about inversions?
Inversions? Well, that's an interesting question. If you have a chromosome inversion,
yeah,
swapping around the chromosome, genes in the middle of the inversion might not know, because they are their local context of upstream and downstream stuff hasn't changed. It's just it's been flipped, but the gene is still functional. So for many loci, it might not matter. If you're near the break point, well, you have to start worrying.
Mm-hmm.
Again, that's going further than the models that are currently in use really do. Okay. Now let's think about proteins. Protein sequences were the first molecular sequences to be analyzed by a bunch of people in the mid 1960s. The first molecular phylogeny, as I mentioned to you, was by Margaret Dayhoff and Richard Eck in 1966, published in 1966. And they are coming to this in a moment. They used parsimony. And I believe, although they never published the details, that they just simply used a model in which each amino acid could change to each other amino acid. The rate, it's just like a Jukes-Kander model, only there's 20 possibilities instead of 4. The formulas would be almost the same, except they weren't using those formulas. They were just counting changes in a parsimony way. Okay. However, Margaret Dayhoff was aware of the rate differences and aware of the fact that the genetic code, which had only been filled out a few years before, constrained the change among amino acids, that it was not true that it was equally likely to go from an alanine to a glycine as it was to go from an arginine to a methionine, let's say. And so what she did was something very interesting. She set out with her database, which they had. In those days, the database would not have been in a computer on a hard disk because there weren't any. Or there were so few, the few that there were not really usable for long-term data storage. But they had it all on, I think the database resided, it was put out in printed form, it resided on punch cards that were read into the computer. So what she decided was to tabulate how many times each amino acid changed to each other. But she didn't just do that. Because, of course, if you look at two species, and you say, well, let's take human and mouse, and let's look at the differences between them, and you could say, well, herein is an alanine and there's a glycine, that we'll count that as one change from alanine to glycine. Somebody may come along and say, wait a second, there's a fairly long branch between human and mouse. If, on the other hand, you look at human and chimp and you see an alanine and a glycine, that's much shorter branch. That's much more likely to be just a single change. So what she did was to use only sequences that were within a certain fraction of difference of each other. In other words, that the whole molecule hadn't changed more than, I don't remember what the number was, but 10% or so. There are only 10% differences. And not to use the larger differences, because there, the thing you observed was likely not to be exactly what had happened. There could have been multiple changes. Furthermore, she scaled them by saying, if we have two sequences that are 5% apart, and we see a change, we compare that to two species that are 10% different, that's in the whole molecule, we're going to take into account the fact that differences seen in the 10% one are amount to changing at a lower rate than differences between the 5%. Let me back up and try to make that clearer. That if you see a difference between two sequences and they overall differ 10%, you count that as a certain number of changes per unit time. If you see them differing at 5%, the overall molecules differ at 5%, you count that as a change in a correspondingly shorter amount of time. In other words, she's using those overall percentage changes as a proxy for how much time there had been for the change. And thus, counting the changes more if they were in a sequence that didn't, it'd be two sequences that didn't differ overall as much. So these are weighted, these counts here are weighted by how much different the two proteins were overall. And what she did was able to tabulate that starting with an alanine, you had this many changes from alanine to alanine. Well, actually alanine to alanine is no change. What she's saying is of, in effect, of 10,000 opportunities to change, two of them went to goes to an arginine, two times to an asparagine. Well, I don't know, the asparagine, aspartic acid, I'm not sure what those two guys, I don't know the names of all the aminos. This is a cysteine, okay. This is glycine, again, I get mixed up, glutamine, glutamic acid, I'm not sure, I don't remember. Histidine, isoleucine, leucine, glycine, methionine, and so on. And she tabulated how many times she had seen these changes. And by the way, this matrix is not symmetrical. So she's also going from lysine to arginine. There it's going 37 times. Lysine and arginine are chemically very similar. And so there's less constraint in evolution on making that change. If you look at the arginine to lysine one that's up here, its two is fairly large for its row, but it's not the same number. So they're, it's an asymmetrical matrix. And then from that, one also gets equilibrium frequencies of these things by means that are, you know, basically by counting. And then there's a way of symmetrizing the matrix. And basically what you get out of this is an empirically derived probability matrix of probabilities of change. She called the PAM matrix a probability of accepted mutation. She was well aware that this wasn't just an issue of mutation, it was an issue of natural selection accepting. So this is one of her tabulated matrices, the so-called PAM-001, which is done for fairly close sequences. She had some others that were for sequences further apart, and I don't want to get into that part of the story. This is the matrix. It sticks off the right side of the slide, and I haven't figured out how to scale it down quite small enough. There is a full version in the book, I believe. So here she had this empirical matrix. And you might say, well, all very well, but doesn't the genetic code affect all this? Well, the answer really is she knew that the genetic code would constrain things, but given the computational resources of the day, she tabulated these empirically, and any constraint due to the genetic code would show up. The hope was that it would show up in this tabulation. It also isn't really the full story because there are, for example, the most notorious example is serine, which has like six different codons that will code for it, and there are two groups that are well separated in the genetic code. So if you see an alanine change to a serine, and somewhere else you see a serine change to a threonine, it might be that those aren't the same serines, those are different underlying codes. Once you get to the serine, it may not be easy to move on to the threonine because you might actually be in the wrong part of the code table. That's a complication that's not taken into account here. Anyway, so this is an attempt to do empirically derived matrices from the database of protein sequences that was available to them in the 60s, which is a fairly small database.
So, of course, let me just...
People have since redone it many times. The one that was has been used a lot, there's one called Jones Taylor Thornton, named after the authors, which is the early 90s, so now 20-odd years ago. That's the JTT model. That was tabulated on a much larger database, so it's very much a Dayhoff-style tabulation. They also did... some of these same authors did tabulation specific to specific kinds of proteins, such as membrane proteins, for example. So they were able to go on and do more data-rich tabulations of probabilities of change from amino acid to amino acid. More recently, there's a, I think it's Vogela and Goldman, Nick Goldman at EBI in Cambridge, UK, and that's the WAG matrix, and there are others. So like WAG is an even more recent tabulation trying to refine that. So there's been a whole literature of further tabulations of these Dayhoff-style PAM matrices, but she really was the first person to do a probability model of change for amino acids based on tabulated empirical data. Okay.
Furthermore, then you can go on and say, okay, well, this is all very well, but let's take the codon table into account. And in 1994, there were two papers published back-to-back in Molecular Biology and Evolution, so obviously they coordinated the publication. I think these probably... I don't know if these authors knew of each other and then submitted them together, or whether they submitted them separately to the same journal, and the journal said, hey, we're already... You know, we've got another paper on that. Why don't we publish them together? But they're published back-to-back, obviously by prearrangement. And basically, they were models that said, look, let's take an underlying DNA model. Well, actually, here it's posed as RNA, which it doesn't matter which way you do it. But this is a genetic code table with the RNA triplets. And let's do the following. Let's have a DNA model running. Let's ban changes to stop codons. Let's forget about them. Let's assume that if a codon is UUA, that when it changes, let's have some rates of DNA of base change in the DNA model. You may say, which DNA model should you use? The answer is, pretty much whatever you want. What they used was one that was very much like the HKY model. So you could have differences of different equilibrium base frequencies, and you could have different transition and transversion rates. There were parameters for those. But then let's do one additional thing. Let's say that when you have a triplet, you have a codon that's UUA, there is a certain probability under this DNA model that it will change in each of its three positions, and in each of those three positions, there are three possible changes that could occur. So there are nine little arrows exiting here. And basically, there you see them. These are all, we're going to color them differently because we're going to say that in addition to having the DNA change according to the DNA model, we're going to have natural selection intervene and stop some of those changes, and select against them strongly enough that they will not show up in divergence of species. One of the things we're going to do is we'll put a red arrow here on the changes that go to a stop codon and say, natural selection doesn't want you in the middle of this protein to have a stop codon. It's going to kill it. So you ban those.
you have a probability of acceptance of the mutation, which is zero for stops. Okay, then there's two other color arrows. There are green ones, and what those are changes that do not change the amino acid. Okay. And those you'll just accept 100% of the time. And then there's the orange ones. These are traffic light colors. Basically, we will have a rate of acceptance for those. They do change the amino acid. Now, I haven't written the formulas down here, and I'm not actually going to, except to say that this builds in some biological reality, but maybe not quite as much reality. It builds in a lot of biological reality with respect to the relation between the amino acids and the DNA sequences. It builds in less reality with respect to which amino acids you change to. In the original Goldman and Yang paper, they had a rather elaborate model where the probability of acceptance of an amino acid change varied according to an assessment of how different those amino acids were. That has not continued to be used mostly in the model. Most programs written since then haven't done that. And I've asked Goldman, Zihan Yang and Nick Goldman, why didn't you keep using that? And they said, because when we tried to fit it to data, we couldn't find any real evidence that it improved things. So what they did instead was Muse and Weir, Spencer Muse and Bruce, our own, who now, this was done at North Carolina State University when Bruce Weir was there, and he's now here in the biostatistics department, former chair of that department. They had a paper, and what they did was something simpler. They just said, there is a probability of acceptance of the change, and they just had a parameter omega. This is, somebody correct my Greek, but I think that's small omega, lowercase omega. And that's simply an acceptance probability. It says, if you change the amino acid, we'll have, say it's 0.32, we'll have a 0.32 chance of accepting that. Now, the catch is, it doesn't actually depend upon which kind of amino acid you change to. If you go from a hydrophilic to a hydrophobic one, it doesn't penalize you more. It just said, oh, I changed the amino acid, maybe that'll not be accepted. It'll be on one of these orange arrows. Nevertheless, the model as it is in use today is mostly the Muse and Weir version. The other is more realistic, but they were claiming that it didn't fit any better. There is room for improvement in this. So basically, the model has one extra parameter, which is the rate of, that you've banned stops, that doesn't need a parameter, and you've reduced the changes that change amino acids. But underlying it is basically a DNA model. So it isn't as rich in biological reality as Dayhoff's PAM, but it does do a better job of forcing consistency with the codon, with the code table. And I should say that another simplification in the model was that if you didn't change the amino acid, it assumed that that was okay with natural selection. Not always okay with natural selection, because different codons, people may remember the subject of codon bias, that some among all the leucine codons, here there are, six of them, some will be used much more than others. And it one of the considerations seems to be that the transfer RNA for those codons may be more, if the gene is under pressure to be highly expressed, you want to rapidly translate. And in doing that, you want to use a codon that has lots of transfer RNA around. So, and in addition, there might be other subtler interactions with neighboring codons, and various kinds of biological complexity that could cause these green arrows not to be occurring at all at the same rate. Okay, so this model is
has, particularly in subsequent work by Zihang Yang, which will be very well covered in the in Zihang's book, which I have as one of the books on reserve here, and at the it is on reserve where? Which one? Oh, it's on reserve at the Health Sciences Library. And in the hands of Zihang, there have been he wrote a program called PAML, which is able to do all kinds of tests involving this codon model. Now, many of you, this is the kind of thing where people come to this course and say, are you going to give 2 weeks of extensive coverage of this? And I have to say, given the number of topics that I've got to cover, no. We're just going to talk about it today. And then I'm going to wave my hands and say, I'm not telling you all the details of all the different models. But there are versions of it where you have rates. This omega thing varies among sites. There are versions where it varies among both sites and branches in the tree. And there are statistical attempts to test that statistically in a likelihood framework, which we mostly haven't gotten to yet. But it's a very, very popular thing to do, and the number of labs locally are furiously doing lots of testing of this model with it and trying to test things, assertions about omega. Is it, does it vary among sites? Does it vary among branches? Does it have, and if omega is below 1, that means one is has a probability of rejecting the change. People also sometimes look at omegas above 1, and what that means is the change is going even faster than you would imagine from the DNA model. It's being encouraged by natural selection. So, and that can happen if you do the population genetics, that is possible. Because most mutants that occur in a population get lost, even and even the favorable ones, most of them get lost with a selection coefficient, a fractional difference in fitness of 2%, let's say, in a population. The probability that a new mutant will get fixed in that population is about twice that, so it's about 4%. So 2% selective advantage, which is quite healthy, on 96% of the time it's getting lost. So there's a lot of room for higher selection coefficients to raise the rates of substitution well above the neutral one. So this omega is a thing saying, is substitution going slower or faster? Substitution to different amino acids, non-synonymous substitution, is that going faster or slower or faster than predicted by a purely neutral model? Anyway, this is a big industry right now, and I'm afraid I'm going to have to mostly skip over it. But, okay, so those are the models that are in use for proteins. This is just a description. I probably should change this table. It talks about Aij as the probability that change is accepted. Aij is usually this omega thing. That really is just what I said before. So if I say, okay, if you want to use a probability model of change in protein sequences, what should you do? Well, the first thing you should do, this is an idealized, but as I say, not very practical approach, is use a good model of DNA evolution. Make it be pretty empirically close to what DNA would do. Use the appropriate genetic code. That's a no-brainer. Have your acceptance probability decline as the amino acids become more different. I do think that that is a real pattern, but exactly how to measure difference is not entirely obvious. Fit all this to empirical information on protein evolution. Take into account that rate of change may vary from site to site. Take into account, even worse, that rates in adjacent sites may be correlated. Because if you're in a protein, you've got a codon that's coding for something in a protein, and that happens to be in an alpha helical part of the protein, the next site is also likely to be in an alpha helical part, so there should be some correlation. And that is just leads us into the structure, to the issue of protein structure. Should you use what you know about secondary structure? And for that matter, should you use what you know about 3D structure? And there have been interesting explorations of fitting models that do that. It carries me beyond both my biological knowledge and the and the level of detail that I can get into here. Of course, for many proteins, you don't know what their secondary structure is. You can actually use some of this. There's been some very interesting work out of David Jones' lab in connection also with Jeff Thorne, where they looked at inferring the secondary structure from the empirically observed probabilities of change in each region. So basically fitting a model that had different possible rates of change according to whether it was an alpha helix, a beta sheet, or other, and then trying by hidden Markov model machinery, which I'm not getting into right now, to infer where the alpha helix might be and where the beta sheet might be based on the amount of change seen across a phylogeny. Mostly that sort of stuff doesn't get used, partly because we don't have secondary structures and 3D structures for every gene. We have them only for a limited set of them. And we don't have them in all species. Usually they're inferred in a few species, and then we sort of assume that the others are similar. So these are some of the realism considerations, but nobody puts them all together. Basically, they're not put together yet into a usable machinery. Okay, so where we're going from here is to likelihood. So I get back in the Ford Model T and I shift gears. Okay. So I think the best thing to do is not to start, since we're down to the last 2 minutes, but to start it next time. What we're going to be doing is I'm going to start by giving you an elementary introduction to likelihood. Now, let me take a survey. How many people here have heard and think they sort of assimilated an introduction to maximum likelihood in some statistical or biological context? I'm just curious. How many think they haven't? One or two. Okay. So things are changing. We're getting into a newer world. For about 30 years after I started talking a lot about likelihood inference in phylogenies, I would go around and give seminars, and I'd come to a department, and particularly when I was not looking at people like in this class, but I was looking at a broader bunch of people who were the biologists in that department and their students, I would look out and I'd say, blah, 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 likelihood, and you'd see glazed eyes, you'd see a wall of glazed eyes. What's likelihood? And I would then have to, for my hour lecture, have to spend the first 20 minutes on the stuff I'm going to give you, telling them, oh, here's what likelihood is. Here's a simple example involving tossing coins, and so on. I had to give them the statistics lecture on what likelihood was. And it made me upset, because they should have learned that in the statistics course that they took. But either they didn't take statistics, or they didn't assimilate it. Or, and in most universities, of course, statistics courses in those days, as to some extent still, were the coalition of the unwilling. I mean, you had a bunch of students who had been forced into this course by course requirements and didn't want to be there. And then you had a poor instructor who was shoved in there and told, you have to teach that, I know you don't want to, but you have to teach all these biologists what statistics is. And so you had, the course would start out already doomed to a path of disaster, in that the students didn't want to hear it, and the instructor didn't want to teach it, and so on. I think it still happens, but probably a little less than it used to. And I think people are, and those kinds of cookbook statistics courses never told you about likelihood. It was regarded as too advanced a topic.
So I think we're getting out of those days. I think people are realizing they have to learn it, and the statisticians are really realizing we have to teach it. So we'll start on that next time. I will release you all, especially those who want to go to the biology seminar.